This talk really falls into four parts. Initially, a brief consideration of the correspondence between NEMA and Kenneth Grant in the early 1970s. Secondly, a consideration of Akkad's magical career, because I think it's necessary to get that background. Thirdly, a brief discussion of Marx in KG's work. And fourthly, assuming that I don't run out of time, the future. In April 1975, as Mitch said earlier, NEMA sent a typescript of Live at Penne Pranumba to Kenneth Grant with no explanation. This is the covering letter she sent. Commentary on the attached document will be written in the near future. Who is Prometheus? I haven't managed to discover what meaning is of that somewhat enigmatic comment there. However, Kenneth Grant replied a few weeks later saying, "The document is of particular interest to me at this time because certain passages and elements which it contains tie up rather remarkably with work I'm currently engaged upon. I therefore look forward to hearing from you again and to receiving your commentary." At this time, Grant's book, Cults of the Shadow, had gone to the printers, and Grant was already working on his next book, Nightside of Eden. He elaborated on these above remarks of his in a subsequent letter that same month. What struck me most forcibly when I first read Live at Penne Pranumba has, however, no immediate or obvious connection with the above considerations. The word ipsos, in two of its spellings, yields numbers that relate it unequivocally to a certain cipher in the Book of the Law that has occupied my attention on and off for very many years. What is more, these two numbers tie up with the central theme of the book I am now writing. These numbers, 456 and 696, may have appeared in your own Kabbalah. If they have, I'd be most interested to know what specific references they have for you. Now, the certain cipher referred to by Grant in this letter appears in verse 76 of chapter 2 of the Book of the Law. And Grant was thinking in particular of one element of that cipher, Rup Slovaal. In a subsequent letter of June 75 by Kenneth Grant, I quote, "Incidentally, my immediately forthcoming book, Cults of the Shadow, contains references to the work of Frater Akkad, Charles Stansfield Jones, who received many intimations of the Ian of Mart, which he did not live long enough to understand or evaluate, in the sense in which they are developed in Live at Penne Pranumba." I think it's plain from these remarks that Grant was already reassessing Akkad's work, and in particular, the Akkad-York correspondence of 1948 and 1949. This is quite noteworthy because he has a chapter on Akkad in Cults of the Shadow, in which he states that he finds Akkad's work very interesting, but there's no evidence for the incoming of the Ian of Truth and Justice. So what was the Akkad-York correspondence of which we speak? When Crowley died in 1947, he directed in his will that his papers be sent over to his appointed successor, Carl Germer, in America. In early 1948, Gerald York, a longtime friend of Crowley and collector of his books, typescripts, diaries and papers, set about going through Crowley's papers and ordering them. He was struck by the omission of Liber 31, the essay by Akkad setting out discovery of Al as the key to the Book of the Law. Crowley had accepted this enthusiastically, even going so far as to change the name from Liber Legis to Liber Alvel Legis. A higher honour, can you imagine? York thought that this was an important document and should be amongst Crowley's papers, and wrote to Akkad to ask for a copy. Akkad replied, and a voluminous correspondence between the two was unleashed, continuing until shortly before Akkad's death in February 1950. Akkad's letters were often lengthy and very frequent. Initially, he provided a great deal of information about his time with Crowley, and his letters are quite riveting on this account alone. Then, from March 1948, Achard started reporting initiations which he was then undergoing, putting them in the context of his previous initiations. Now, it was quite clear now that his initiations were coming to a head. And I think that now would be a very good time for a brief outline, for want of a better term, of his magical career. Achard was born in London in 1888. He came across Crowley's journal, The Equinox, in 1909, and joined the AA as a probationer later that year, taking the name Achard, a Hebrew word meaning one. His supervisor in the AA was initially Captain JFC Fuller. And then, shortly afterwards, Fuller broke with Crowley, and Crowley became the direct supervisor of Achard and began to take a keen interest in him. Achard was also a member of the OTO and made rapid progress through the grades of that order, reaching the ninth degree in June 1916. This was a time of intense mystical and magical activity for Achard, as his subsequent account makes clear. And I quote from his subsequent account. The culmination came at the summer solstice of 1916, when, having done my best to strip myself of all that I had and was in the personal sense, I underwent a great initiation, obtaining, for one thing, Atmadarshana, and with it, or following it, a very great spiritual insight into the workings of the order of the AA and into the cosmic plan on the higher planes. This experience, as was afterwards discovered, clearly indicated the fulfillment of the prophecy made in 1904, before I knew anything of the order, and gave me a certain magical link with the outer head of the order, which he could not but recognize and has since continued to do so. Achard, who was technically a zealoter in the AA, took the oath of the abyss on the 21st of June, 1916, swearing to interpret every event as a particular dealing of God with his soul. He was reborn as Frater IOVBIO, Magister Templi. This attainment of Achard's had a considerable impact on Crowley. For several years, Crowley had been preoccupied with the need for a successor. Crowley being Crowley, he envisaged that successor as a magical son, and he conducted a series of sex magical operations for that purpose. On hearing the news of Achard's attainment, Crowley decided that Achard was clearly the magical son born from the sex magical operations that he had undertaken to bring about a magical son. Furthermore, because of Achard's magical motto, meaning one, he could see that Achard was the one spoken of in the Book of the Law, who would come after the beast and who would solve the mysteries of the book, but he, the prophet, couldn't. Now, as a result of this, Achard became Crowley's right-hand man. At the end of March 1918, Achard moved to New York and took part in many of the subsequent sessions of the Amalantra working, which had started in January that year. The existing record of the working concludes in June 1918, and shortly afterwards, Crowley went to Aesopus Island for a magical retirement. He was visited on occasions by his former mistress and seer of the Amalantra working, Roddy Minor, and on a few other occasions by Achard himself. Shortly afterwards, in September 1918, Achard began having a series of insights into the Book of the Law and came to see that the Hebrew word al and its reverse la, which mean God and not respectively, were key to understanding the book. He started recording this and other insights in a document that consisted largely of diary entries, and he later called this Liber 31. He chose this name because the Hebrew word al enumerates as 31. Achard completed Liber 31 in early November 1918, but decided not to pass it to Crowley for the time being. In March 1919, Crowley published the Blue Equinox. This issue This issue included extracts from Urquhart's magical records as the first part of several projected parts, setting out his attainment as a master of the temple. This photograph of Urquhart shows him in meditation and was used in the Blue Equinox. In September 1919, a year after he first had the insights, Urquhart finally sent Crowley his Liber 31, Keys to the Book of the Law. Crowley was overjoyed to receive it, overjoyed at Urquhart's insights, and augmented the title to Liber Alvel Libis. Unfortunately, this was the high point of the relationship between Urquhart and Crowley. And shortly afterwards, relations between the two men became strained, and then very strained. In 1920, Urquhart had been introduced to another order, the Universal Brotherhood, of which Crowley took a dim view, a very dim view indeed. Urquhart tried to interest his friends and colleagues in the Universal Brotherhood with varying degrees of success. When I say varying, I really mean very little. Nevertheless, Urquhart became increasingly absorbed in the work of the Universal Brotherhood throughout the 1920s, to Crowley's annoyance, and indeed he eventually became its head. In 1921, the then head of the OTO, Theodore Royce, issued Urquhart with a charter appointing him as head of the OTO for North America. Crowley had previously maintained that North America was actually within his jurisdiction. And so this became another point of annoyance and conflict and disenchantment between the two. This period of time of the early 1920s was actually a very creative one for Urquhart. He published QBL or The Bride's Reception in 1922, The Egyptian Revival in 1923, and The Anatomy of the Body of God in 1925. These are considered his three major works, but he also published others, notably in 1923, 31 Hymns to the Star Goddess, Crystal Vision through Crystal Gazing, and the Chalice of Ecstasy. He also published a diagram, The Wheel of the Tarot, an amazing compilation, really, setting out in great detail cards of the tarot pack to the constellations and the decanets. And I've been using that myself in a magical working that I've had that's actually been underway for about 18 months now. Urquhart had also become extremely interested in references in the Book of the Law, in particular chapter 3, verse 34, which Crowley had interpreted as referring to the Aeon, to succeed the Aeon of Horus. I'll just quote it. "But your holy place shall be untouched throughout the centuries, though with fire and sword it be burnt down and shattered, yet an invisible house there standeth, and shall stand until the fall of the great equinox, when Hurumakis shall arise, and the double-wonded one assume my throne and place." Crowley's old comment to this verse included the following passage. "Following him, Horus, will arise the equinox of Ma, the goddess of justice. It may be 100 or 10,000 years from now, for the computation of time is not here as there." At this stage, Crowley wasn't tying in the eons to the precession of the equinoxes, i.e. approximately 2,000 years apart. In the early 1920s, Crowley wrote another longer comment called The New Comment, and it made further interesting remarks on the relationship between the two eons, Aeon of Horus and the Aeon of Ma. "There is no violent antithesis as that between Osiris and Horus. Strength shall prepare the reign of justice. We should begin already, as I deem, to regard this justice as the ideal, whose way we should make ready by virtue of our force and fire. The aeon to come after Horus was characterized by Akkad as the aeon of truth and justice, and also known as the aeon of Maat or Maat. Crowley was interested in this too, but expected Akkad to concentrate on the system end in his work of propagating the aeon of Horus. There were, though, other sources of tension. As we've seen, Akkad was by now writing and publishing his own books, and Crowley disliked the books intensely. Another was over Crowley's stock of books, which he'd arranged to be sent over from England. Akkad paid for their storage. He was authorized by Crowley to sell these books, keeping a proportion of the money for himself and forwarding the rest to Crowley. Crowley came to suspect that Akkad was defrauding him and set up a committee to investigate the matter. Perhaps not surprisingly, this hand-picked committee found in Crowley's favor, and a legal document, the release, was drawn up to settle and then to sever financial relations between the two men, a document that was executed in June 1926. For some years, Akkad had focused his work in the Universal Brotherhood, and that work continued and indeed intensified throughout the period of deteriorating relationships with Crowley. Shortly before the release, he received a word, manio. I've not come across any accounts by Akkad of how this word was received, nor what he thought it meant. Many years later, however, in his correspondence of 1948 with Gerald York, Akkad speculated that this may have been the word which Crowley had tried and failed to receive in connection with his attainment to the grade of Magus. Writing to York in 1948, Akkad quoted from a letter which Crowley had written to him in July 1916 about the problems he was having waiting to receive his word as Magus, and I quote, "I'm still in profundis. I wrote an essay on God as a sadist 2 days ago, and yesterday went through a big magical ceremony, but nothing seems to revive me. I can't learn to wait for the word properly. I believe if I could only do that for 10 minutes, the word would come." Akkad continued in his letter to York. About 10 years later, on May the 8th, 1926, at 6:19 p.m. in Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, in the presence of a living witness to whom it was immediately communicated, the word was obtained by one which Leiberligus prophesied should obtain the key of it all. This word, when comprehended rightly, clearly shows this, for it contains many formulae and special virtues. Akkad's initiations continued in 1932 with what he referred to as the Silver Star Initiations, and to mark which he designed a rather lovely letterhead, which is this letterhead here. Relationships of some sort between the two, Akkad and Crowley, were re-established by Crowley in 1936. He was working on the Equinox of the Gods and wished to write about Akkad's discovery in 1918 of Al as the key to the Book of the Law. For a while, the correspondence between the two men was respectful and positive, Crowley stating that he thought Akkad's role in plumbing the depths of the Book of the Law had a lot further to go. He also acknowledged Akkad's role in preparing for the Aeon of Truth and Justice. Take, for instance, this passage from Crowley's letter to Akkad of July 1936. "Your preparations for the Aeon of Justice seem to me personal to yourself, incidents in the course of your initiation, and I have no doubt that they will flower at the fall of the great equinox. But I think that your position in respect to the Aeon of Horus is to be considered of supreme importance at this juncture. I do not at all think that your work in respect of the Book of the Law has passed beyond its beginning. I regard the curious experience through which you have passed as the necessary training for the full assumption of your office." Well, that's pretty positive stuff. However, the correspondence descended shortly afterwards into mutual suspicion and acrimony, and Crowley brought up again his conviction that Arkad had stolen his books way back in the early 20s. The correspondence ended with Crowley issuing a notice of the expulsion of Arkad from the OTO. In 1936, Arkad established a lodge, Emmanuel Lodge, for the purpose of establishing the ritual transmission of Manio, concentrated in three initiatory degrees. Interestingly, he established this lodge not within the Universal Brotherhood, but using a charter he had had in the 1920s from Heinrich Trenker for the establishment of Pansophia in America. That's actually the letterhead of the Collegium Pansophicum in America. And it's basically, I'm sure you recognize it as the Rosicrucian design. After Crowley's death in December 1947, Gerald York ordered Crowley's papers preparatory to them being shipped to Burma in accordance with Crowley's will. He noticed that there was not amongst Crowley's papers a copy of Liber 31, the document from 1918 in which Arkad had set out his discovery of Al as the keys of the Book of the Law. He thought that there should be a copy and wrote to Arkad to ask for one. This initiated the correspondence between Arkad and York that is referred to as the Arkad-York correspondence. Arkad and York, in fact, shared notes about their respective experiences with Crowley. And in particular, Arkad gave a great deal of background information about his time with Crowley up until their break of 1926. Then, in early 1948, Arkad announced that he had detected the incoming of the Aeon of Truth and Justice. This is something which was subsequently discussed between Arkad and York. York made it plain that he'd never been happy with what he saw as the harshness, the force and fire of Horus, and was only too happy at the idea of an ameliorating influence. However, he could not and would not believe that the Aeon of Horus had ended in 1948 after a mere 44 years from 1904. Arkad maintained that the incoming of the Aeon of Truth and Justice did not mean that the Aeon of Horus had been cut short, but that, on the contrary, it was continued in the Aeon of Truth and Justice. Interestingly, support for this view can be found in Crowley's work. For instance, as mentioned earlier, the new comment to this particular verse, verse 34 in chapter 3 of the Book of the Law. There is no violent antithesis as that between Osiris and Horus. Strength will prepare the reign of justice. We should begin already, as I deem, to regard this justice as the ideal, whose way we should make ready by virtue of our force and fire. Then, in the summer of 1948, York became aware that Arkad had recently come across a collection of diaries, notebooks, and typescripts that he'd left with Arkad when leaving America for Chevalu. Being a collector, York was anxious to get his hands on these documents, or at least on copies of them. Arkad was hesitant, York pushed a little too hard, and as a result, relations between Arkad and he cooled significantly, and their letters became less frequent. Arkad died in February 1950. Arkad's work on the Aeon of Mark was not continued by his successors in the Universal Brotherhood. I don't think they really understood Arkad's work, but they sensed that it was important and should be preserved until the time came when it could be understood. At the end of 1950, Grant made typed copies of the Arkad-York correspondence for Gerald York's archives, retaining a carbon typescript copy in his own files. At the same time, he became very interested in Arkad's work, borrowing from York the three major works, QBL, the Egyptian Revival, and the Anatomy of the Body of God. In remembering Alistair Crowley, Grant described Eastern mysticism as his first love. In 1950, he developed a growing interest in Advaita Vedanta, in particular, the works of Ramana Maharshi, who had died earlier that year. His interest became so great that for a couple of years, he lost interest altogether in Western magic. Then, in 1954, his interest in magic returned, but Advaita remained at the heart of his work subsequently, all the way through the Tibetan trilogies. Gerald York introduced him to the work of the German occultist Eugen Groscher through his regular magazine, Blätter für Lebenskunst. And Grant took a particular interest in several articles on a transplutonic planet called Isis. Grant established New Isis Lodge to work with the energies transmitted by this planet and drew up a series of grade rituals for the degrees of the lodge, which ranged from 0 to 11. To each of the degrees was assigned a planet, Earth to 0 degree, Moon to the 1st degree, etc., culminating in the transplutonic Isis assigned to the 11th degree. This is it here. This is one of the papers from this period when Grant was establishing the New Isis Lodge. And this is actually a synopsis, a very brief synopsis of grades. And it assigns a keyword for each grade, followed by an explanatory gloss upon that keyword. The keyword and gloss for the final degree, the 11th, is of particular interest. 11th degree Isis, realization of inherent identity with the dream cosmos and its creator and energy bestower, New Isis. In 1948, Grant had begun to study and to assimilate the voluminous works of Gerald Massey, taking a particular interest in the account therein of the generatrix, the primal goddess Ta-Earth, or Hakau, who is deemed to have generated the universe. Now, as the grade description makes clear, this had become fused with Advaita and with Nuit in the form of New Isis, it amounts to the same thing. It brings to mind something from the Upanishads. We are like the spider. We weave our web and move along in it. We are like the dreamer who dreams and then lives in the dream. This is true for the whole world. Grant clearly identified with the spider's web. Over the decades, he took on several forms of his magical name, Aosik, and one such was Aosik Iwas, from which he derived the number 718. It just so happens that the Hebrew for spider's web, Kavriot Bish, enumerates as 718. This is shown very clearly on the front cover of Outside the Circles of Time. I want to quote a passage from Outside the Circles of Time. Myths and legends are of the past, but March should not be thought of in terms of past or future eons. Mart is present now for those who, knowing the sacred alignments and the gateway of in-betweenness, experience the word ever coming, ever remaining from the mouth, in the ever new and ever present forms that are continually being generated from the mystical Atu, or the house of Mart, the Mart Atu. This passage for me evokes so much. It suggests Ipsos by the same mouth. It suggests that Mart is identified with the genetrix Ta-Urt or Ur-Hakau, who is generating the universe, generating reality, generating the dream cosmos, not as a single historical event, but indeed is continually generating these images. Well, I've got a few minutes left. So I'm going to move on now to the future. I was very fortunate. When Kenneth Grant died, his widow, Steffi, allowed me access to Kenneth Grant's papers to help me in the preparation of reprints of the Tithonian trilogies. And amongst the papers were a good many relating to New Isis Lodge, in particular the formation of New Isis Lodge, grade work papers, all sorts of things like that. And I found them very interesting. What I found, though, was that in the course of reading them, in the course of studying them, the whole thing was reactivated. And this was very useful to me because I'd become aware of the need for regeneration of the order following the death of Kenneth Grant. You know, we couldn't spend the rest of our time just in Kenneth Grant's works, just in propagating Kenneth Grant's works. That's a very necessary job to do, and that is something that will always do that. But things move on. And Kenneth Grant said to me one day that he hoped that I would continue his work after his death. And that's actually what I'm doing. And I found by studying these papers that a number of magical workings and rituals suggested themselves to me. And there was one in particular which basically involves envisaging New Isis, the generator and sustainer of the dream cosmos, as a spider, as a huge spider's web. And across this web are exuded drops of dew. And these drops of dew, they precipitate across space and time as moments of epiphany, as gateways back to remembrance of our real cosmic identity. I have to say, it's bloody exciting work, and I love every minute of it.